Take a network break. Welcome to the Packet Pusher's weekly analysis of tech news and vendor announcements, fueled by virtual donuts, caffeine, and informed cynicism. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. Today's show is sponsored in part by ExtraHop, the leader in real-time IT analytics and the pioneer of wire data, the ultimate lens into digital transactions. The ExtraHop platform provides insight across the IT environment, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. If you tweet at ExtraHop and mention Packet Pushers, you can get a free t-shirt, and you can learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself at extrahop.com/demo. To the news, Cisco has decided to go all in with its hyperconverged partner SpringPath. They are buying the company outright. They're plunking down $320 million for the company that makes the file system software in Cisco's HyperFlex HCI product.
Don't try and say that too fast. Hyperconverged, HyperFlex, SpringPath, Cisco HCS. Yeah, this is interesting for several reasons, one of which is that Cisco normally just buys its startups outright. And for those of you who remember the debacle around the UCS's Invicta, the storage strategy where they bought a storage vendor and then it just didn't work.
Right.
Turns out, and they'd scaled it up and pushed it into the channel and the channel had gone out there and sold it and it just didn't. So lots of unhappy customers, and Cisco obviously didn't look too good coming out of that engagement, which is why, you know, you should never buy new products from Cisco, really, because they always get them wrong. But this time they finally put a ring on SpringPath's finger, in the sense that I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, certainly in the time we talked about them on Network Break, I think.
Yeah, that they actually, it was sort of a try before you buy deal by partnering with them without.
Yeah, that's right.
They were an OEM. And
And they sort of bought a substantial proportion of the company. I think SpringPath was about to go broke and be done with or something like that. Nobody really knew. There's lots of rumors and scuttlebutt, so we're just speculating here. The rumor was that Cisco bought either a majority stake or a substantial stake in the company. So now they're actually plunking down $320 million. They're probably buying most of their own stake as well as whoever's left in the business. Mm-hmm. It's probably a good exit for them. That seems like a lot of money for a company that rumor had it was close to being on the ropes at the time that Cisco moved in and took a position. I do wonder, ultimately, SpringPath is a distributed storage system. You can take any UCS server, of course, now, you know, and put lots of hard drives in it, and SpringPath will fundamentally turn it into a storage array, mm-hmm. a bit like VMware's vSAN or any other number of distributed storage solutions. It does put them head-to-head, in a sense, with VMware against vSAN, but Cisco has also partnered heavily with just about every other storage vendor out there to build a hyperconverged platform, and so is HPE, for that matter. And I wonder what those storage companies think that Cisco's basically backed a winner in the storage space. It's going to be SpringPath. Where does that leave, you know, NetApp or Tintri or any of the other 10 storage partners that Cisco's got?
I mean, I think it leaves them where they were 2 years ago when Cisco went down this road. I think Cisco is taking a broader approach to HCI and saying, you know, we'll give you the various configurations you want. And so we've got our own, but we'll also partner with folks if that makes you happy. So, you know, I'm sure mm-hmm. the other storage vendors aren't thrilled about it, but if they hadn't seen it coming, they should have.
Yeah, I think so. I think I would imagine that the VC community would have been looking for Cisco to buy a storage company and been hopeful that, you know, that of the 30 or 40 of them, that maybe they would have got there, if you know
sure,
what I'm
saying. Sure, yeah. I'm sure. Know, yes.
Maybe it could have been us. But this sort of takes Cisco out of the market for a storage vendor, unless they want to buy an array company, like somebody who's actually got a hardware-based array. And I find that difficult to believe. They've got all these other lucrative partnerships that seem to be generating good revenues, like the UCS business is growing slowly but steadily. It's not shrinking like most of the other business units. Mm-hmm. And Cisco must be using those partners as a way of pulling UCS into other accounts. And, of course, we saw a few weeks ago we were talking about HPE steadily buying up, sealing Cisco out, like its partnerships with Arista, and obviously mm-hmm. Aruba is producing its own switches. It's sort of edging Cisco out and just trying to say, well, you know, where we are in control of accounts, we'll make sure there's no Cisco because we don't want them. I suspect this is what a strategic play where HPE doesn't really want Cisco in its accounts, because once they've got the networking kit in there, the salespeople keep knocking on the door and going, you should buy our servers, you know?
Right. So, yeah, a couple other points. There's a Cisco blog we have a link to that says the acquisition is, quote, strategic to our data center portfolio. I think that's a key word there, strategic. as they transition to delivering software-centric solutions. So another stake in the ground of Cisco saying, yes, we understand software is essential and look at how we're developing out our software portfolio. Second thing is we're talking about growing and shrinking. An IDC report from June 2017 says the worldwide hyperconverged sales grew 64.7% year over year. That's a growth number that I think Cisco is very happy to get a little piece of the action there.
Yeah, I think hyperconverged obviously is a reaction to public cloud. This idea of, you know, buying Lego blocks and assembling them, snapping them together yourself in your favorite pattern, sort of going away, and the speed at which technology is getting smaller, this is something I've talked about for a long time now, means it's pointless buying servers, buying storage arrays, buying network, and then doing self-assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up looking like, you know, the go-kart you made when you were a teenager.
Sure.
And if you want a sure sign that that's the case, then have a look at Azure Private Cloud. You can only buy that from HPE or Dell or Cisco, or I think Lenovo is the next one. And they have dedicated, certified, you can only buy this hardware, and it comes in like a half rack or a rack, and that's Azure Private Cloud. Boom, done. There's no choice around the hardware that you get, or very limited set of choices,
right?
A restricted set of choices. So it's going to be... you know, this hyperconverged, I think, will ultimately be where we are, where you go and say, oh, I need to get an upgrade. I'll get a half rack of hyperconverged something.
Mm-hmm. And of course, slot once you go down. You go.
Yeah, but and the trick here, of course, is right now, once you if you can get your hyperconverged platform through the door, you're probably going to get every subsequent sale thereafter because people will be using that software. You're unlikely to be using like a HPE hyperconverged and a Cisco UCS hyperconverged and
Sure. It's the classic lock-in.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I do think so.
But if you don't like it, then there's OpenStack waiting there for you and you can go deal with that. So you have a choice.
Well, that ultimately is the only alternative today, which is a bit of a struggle.
All right, moving on, but sticking with Cisco, the company has announced its intentions to make ACI available in AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud Platform. They didn't actually attach a timeline to the announcement, but they did provide a few details as to just what they mean. So for instance, you can set your policies in the APIC controller. You can extend them into the public cloud via API, so you get uniform policy and automation. You can create a hybrid cloud, so that's your private premises plus public cloud using ACI, and quote, software designed by cloud providers. So they're essentially trying to build that linkage like VMware is doing with AWS, so you can move workloads from private to public cloud.
Yeah, so first of all, mea culpa. I think I said last week, it was just last week I got this wrong. So yeah, yay me. I said that I didn't see quite how ACI could be mapped into the public cloud and that they're unlikely to do that. Mm-hmm. And so now they come out with a blog post, so perhaps they're listening.
Just to spite you, they said, oh yeah, watch.
Oh yeah, yeah. Greg said
hold
that,
my beer.
Like as if Cisco listens to this. But I think the question in my mind is, I did some more research on ACI this week thinking about it, and the thing that's in the back of my mind is that there are a lot of features of ACI and APIC that really rely on the enhanced functionality that Cisco is winding into the silicon. And in the cloud, there's a dead set of restrictions around what you can do and the way you can do things. And there's a second launch this week of a vSwitch, the ACI vSwitch, which can go into the instances that you run in the cloud, which ACI can get greater control of the network. This seems to be very confusing way to go about things. You're going to have a situation where you have one set of features in the public cloud. You have another set of features if you're using the ACI switch agent. You're going to have another set of features in your private cloud, like in your data center. And if you're using HCI, you know, some sort of hyperconverged, it's going to be different again. And, you know, mapping those features into some sort of unified interface is going to be a really tricky thing. And it could actually be something that makes, well, the thing that's causing us so much pain in enterprise IT is this idea of complexity and feature, you know, just feature density or feature fetish, really. We just have this fetish with unlimited features because, hey, maybe one day we might need them sort of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just sort of feel that this might be, you know, Cisco has to do this, of course. ACI must have a multi-cloud strategy because that's what VMware is winning on. And we'll talk more about that further down in the show. NSX has got a very strong multi-cloud story. And I think VMware is sort of stealing a race here and Cisco sort of having to adapt to keep up. But I do wonder just how ACI, which was very much designed to be in the data center on the network, not above the network and not outside the data center, how hard it's going to be for them to achieve that. So I would be just a little cautious to see how long it takes Cisco to get this right. You know, of course, Cisco's got unlimited resources to throw at these products if they believe that they're critical to the company, and they keep making noises that ACI is the way forward in the data center for them. So let's just wait and see. I wouldn't be holding my breath on this one, I think.
This is early days. Yeah, like I said, there's no timeline announced with this, so it's aspirational more than anything else at this point. But I do agree that Cisco does have to do something, and VMware is stealing a march on them with particularly NSX being a bridge into the public cloud. So clearly a response here from Cisco.
Yeah, I would think, you know, this again is the smelly hobo turning up on it, you know, and chasing everybody away. I think Cisco would be getting concerned that hybrid cloud might be getting away from them. We know Cisco's been talking about hybrid cloud for 5 years now and still doesn't have a rational response to it. And so we'll just have to see how this turns out. I would say that Cisco will be working hard. Let's see what ships and see if it works when it ships.
My perspective is that Cisco's initial approach to hybrid cloud was, let's try to tie this to our hardware, and that approach did not work. And so now they're saying, all right, we've got to do something that's more software-centric, and here's our second take at it.
Yeah, and that's confusing, right? If you're a customer and you're starting to get these mixed messages like, you know, it's all just software, we'll do it in the public cloud. Oh, except when it's on-premises and it's definitely
right,
hardware.
Then it's hardware.
You know, like that's a tension that you have to, that's very difficult to resolve. You've got to have consistent... You know, it's like this week I did some more work researching Tetration, and the original pitch behind Cisco's Tetration product was that it was very much had to be with ACI, only ran on Cisco's custom hardware. And I just sort of went, well, you know, that's not a product anybody's going to be interested in unless you're all Cisco, and put it to a side. Turns out Tetration's actually a standalone product, works with anything. And that wasn't clear. And I think that hardware dependent thing is actually... Cisco needs to sort of lighten up on that and be a little bit more embracing, because I think it is pushing, makes the messaging very complex and leads customers to be confused.
Absolutely. All right, well, moving on. Google, they have announced new two-tier pricing options for their network services in Google Cloud Platform. Customers can use the premium tier, which puts all your traffic across Google's private global backbone, or the standard tier, which puts your traffic on ISP networks instead of Google's private one.
I don't know why this blog post exists. Google's talked many times about the fact that it has like this world-leading private WAN that it built. It's and they've called it the B4, B5, B3 network, and they've put blog posts out about how they use their own SDN controller to control it and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden it's been productized. And
it
you
has,
can now
indeed.
Route your traffic over the private WAN or the public, you know, over the internet. Now, again, a bit of confused product messaging in the blog post that came out. Like, they didn't even make a big press release, and there's no briefing or anything like that. It was confusing to me.
I was also a little confused. They say right now that current Google Cloud customers are using premium by default. I guess maybe they're thinking if customers feel like they need to cut costs somewhere, they could tier some applications down to standard, which they said is going to be priced about 24 to 33% lower than premium. So, you know, if they're trying to compete on cost, they now give customers more of an option. But yeah, at the same time, I also felt like there was a subtext there that if you're a cheapo and you don't really care about your traffic, go ahead and use the smelly old public internet, but, you know, stick with us on the premium.
I do. Yeah. Well, obviously, I mean, I think there is a message here that the internet has become a second class network because of the weakness of BGP, right? I have a longstanding rant around BGP, and people sort of go, oh, but the internet, it's so amazing. I'm going, yes, but the BGP selects only a path, and it's certainly not necessarily the best one or the shortest one or a latency free one. It's whatever companies can do to suck all the traffic through their networks. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's every incentive to make your network the worst performing, because that's when you make the most money, because you're actually sucking all the traffic through your network. Mm-hmm. So it's a tragedy of the commons, really. And that's why we have companies like ThousandEyes and Kentek and, you know, DeepField out there providing visibility into the internet to help you try and debug when it's broken, which is most of the time. I just wonder why Google's trying to break down this pricing, like give you some cheaper pricing. It's as if Azure and AWS both have the private MPLS services, and I'm not sure that Google does. I think it might. So if you're going to want premium bandwidth, you just go and direct connect over a private MPLS connection. if you want to get bandwidth between the sites. So Google was saying, we've got a private WAN. You can use our expensive bandwidth between sites, or you can we can route it out to the internet, and then it gets a little bit more unreliable, but it's not inside our control.
Right.
So maybe it's just a pricing exercise and a strategic play to reduce costs for customers who are saying, why is your bandwidth so expensive?
So, I think that's part of it. And also maybe looking for some differentiation between Azure and AWS, because Google has a lot of catching up to do by saying, I mean, maybe not backhanded, but forehand way of saying our private backbone is awesome, way better than the internet, and you're already using it. And if it's too expensive for you, we'll give you a cheaper option. But you know, ours is super awesome.
Yes, we used to have sugar-coated Cheerios, and we have non-sugar-coated Cheerios. And
right.
We've introduced a product below this one to make the sugar-coated Cheerios look better.
I think that's it. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Although I will also say the SD-WAN market has been built out on the premises that the public internet is just fine as your transport layer. So take that as you will.
Yes.
And in other Google news, the search giant is partnering with VMware to enable Google's Chrome OS to be managed by VMware's endpoint management software. That's from an AirWatch acquisition that VMware made a few years ago. So the idea is that IT admins are going to be able to onboard and configure Chromebooks, set policies, provision apps, and so on. I think the goal here is to boost Google and their Chrome OS in the enterprise.
So end-user compute is a big business for VMware. Obviously, between Citrix and VMware, the end-user compute or the thin client market's pretty much wrapped up in the enterprise space. And I think this might be a play to get into the educational market, where Microsoft has been quite successful with their educational licensing programs. But if you could run Chrome in a thin client, so literally give kids a Chrome tablet or a Chrome notebook, and then start to run it in a thin client, then you've got a situation where even if they lose the laptop or the notebook or, you know, whatever device they're running it on, it's actually running on a thin client. So if you believe the model that people want to use Chrome because it's tear awesome, and, you know, Google's often providing it free for schools and education systems, then making it even less dependent on a single device so that all the settings and the configuration is held in a centralized server somewhere, I think that's what this is aiming for. Now, for VMware, of course, this expands the use of their end-user compute. The end-user compute division is another financial highlight for VMware. They announced the results. That business unit was growing at 30% in the current quarter. So these sorts of partnerships that VMware is doing, and we've seen VMware just make a lot of partnerships and seemingly make hay out of some of them. So that's what I think is happening here.
Yeah, there's definitely a thin client play that I think both organizations, Google and VMware, are highlighting in their messaging around the use of Chromebooks and Chrome OS. I think Google has a pretty good stake in the U.S. education market, certainly. And I think, so they feel like they've got that and they're trying to move into the broader enterprise. Maybe it's an opportunity for VMware to get into the education market as well, because certainly when you're giving kids a laptop, you want to have their access to certain sites as locked down as hard as you can, because you don't want them doing things they shouldn't be doing on school property with school property.
I think it's also administrative. If you've got all the settings and all the smarts, you know, somewhere else, and what's in the hands of the children is, you know, so whether they're at home on their mum and dad's computer, they can still access their Chrome interface.
They can still access, they can get apps.
They can get apps and get their work and their, you know, all the stat, blah, blah, blah. That's maybe that's where this is going. A little hard to tell. I'm not an end user compute expert. And, you know, if people have got white papers or something that I should review, then please email them in.
Yeah, but interesting to see VMware and Google sewing up a partnership here.
Yes.
All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, ExtraHop. ExtraHop is the leader in real-time IT analytics and a pioneer of wire data. That's the window into digital transactions. They provide insight across the IT environment, from the data center to the edge to the cloud, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and the customer experience. For too long, IT has thought of the network as either the plumbing or the problem. But with ExtraHop, the network becomes the biggest source of real-time visibility for IT. That's because ExtraHop does analysis first and then stores packets, which creates wired data, encompassing all the interactions between IT systems and the organizations that rely on them. Wired data is rich, real-time, observed, and objective, and analyzing it at scale transforms the network from a transport function to the foundation of all digital experience. With ExtraHop, companies like T-Mobile, Google, Adobe, Netflix, and Expedia save millions of dollars and thousands of hours, improving application response times by more than 70% and mean time to resolution by up to 90%. To learn more about ExtraHop and to try it for yourself, visit them at extrahop.com/demo. Connect with them on Twitter as @ExtraHop. And if you mention Packet Pushers, you'll receive a free t-shirt. ExtraHop, it's instant insight for IT. Back to the news. Last week, we had talked about how the web hosting company DreamHost was pushing back against a search warrant that wanted information about visitors to a website that had organized protests at the Trump inauguration. DreamHost argued the warrant was overly broad and would violate users' constitutional rights. Now, Reuters is reporting that a district court has in fact approved the warrant, though the judge is going to, quote, oversee the review of data to require the government to explain how it's going to ensure that no innocent user's data gets sewn up here.
Yeah, so I don't really want to offer any comment here politically, but other than to say that, you know, this is court authorized, obviously the legal system in which we operate thing. And to some extent, the court seems to have walked back the breadth of the warrant. So some of the articles I read suggested that, you know, instead of it just being a phishing exercise, they forced the police to restrict the scope of the request down to something a little bit more reasonable and to just ask what's relevant for relevant data only. And that leads DreamHost to declare victory, whether it is or it isn't, that's up to you to decide. And I just wanted to be able to follow up from last week's piece where we talked about this.
That's right. So the Department of Justice has to present the court with a minimization plan. The judge is going to be overseeing the whole process, and there are some rules in place to try to minimize the scope. And yes, we have a link to the DreamHost blog where they do declare victory. I suppose getting a minimization on this broad warrant is, but it's still an interesting subject, and we'll leave it there and you can go look at the stories and figure it out for yourself.
Yep. Yeah. Just want to reiterate our avoidance of politics here. A couple of people picked up on us a couple of weeks ago when we talked about
it. Last week we did not avoid it.
No. But, you know, so it's not meant to be a political piece. It's meant to be tech news that, you know, these are issues that we need to be considering.
That's right. All right. Broadcom's acquisition of Brocade Communications has taken another baby step closer to becoming a done deal. The acquisition has received conditional approval from China's Commerce Ministry. This acquisition process has been kind of a long slog with different government bodies, making sure that Broadcom isn't going to walk away with, I guess, essentially a monopoly in fiber channel networking.
Of course it is. That's what's
well, yeah, that's what it's going to happen. But but it looks like they're getting the blessings for this monopoly, I should say.
Yeah, I noticed. So it's good for Brocade in that the exit, I just don't know quite what's going to happen with Brocade. They did announce their results yesterday.
Just
I
this
think?
Week, yeah. Yes. Well, yeah, the Friday we're recording this on.
And revenue, of course, is down quite substantially. Profits are down a little bit. Shares are down a little bit. But, you know, the company is effectively in limbo. If you're a customer committing to, you know, what's left of Brocade in the fiber channel, you might be holding off on your purchases while you wait to see where this transition goes through. And obviously, not all of the Ethernet and stuff has been sold off yet. There's a lot of those businesses are still waiting approvals. I think this acquisition has to go through first before Extreme gets its hands on the switches and stuff.
This is the logjam before companies like Extreme and Aris can pick up the pieces they were getting from Brocade, yes.
Yeah, it's just not clear to me if those products are sold and gone and done and Brocade has sold them off and then Brocade is waiting to buy what's left or whether the acquisition has to go through before the rest of it comes out the other side. Either way, Brocade's still, you know, holding on. Business hasn't fallen out of the floor. It's declining as you might expect. And Brocade passed another hurdle in China with its approvals.
My anticipation is that the next time we talk about this acquisition, it's going to be a done deal and wrapped up, and then the subsequent acquisitions can move on, and then we'll see how it goes from there.
That's it.
Yeah. That's it.
And I don't think anybody really cares about Fiber Channel, to be fair.
Somebody does, because Broadcom's spending $5.5 billion, so.
Yes. People care about life insurance policies too, but that's because they make a lot of money.
True. Okay, SDX is reporting that Ericsson might be cutting as many as 25,000 employees as part of a broader cost savings plan. SDX cited a story in a Swedish newspaper that said the layoffs would happen outside of that country.
Well, you know, we mentioned a few times, we try not to talk too much about businesses, but Ericsson seems to be in a very weak position. Much of the company is based on services and contract management, and that whole business is under threat as telcos start to look at open source and moving away from, you know, like buying other people's products and operating off-the-shelf stuff and moving into a, you know, COTS, open source, open daylight, CORD, ONOS type environment. And the delays in revenue would obviously be quite difficult for Ericsson because instantly you've got all of these people sitting on the shelf that you have to pay for, but then the money's not coming in to cover their costs. So second thing is that the transition to 5G is not happening quickly. It's going to be, obviously, this is going to be a long, slow transition. I don't think the race away from 4G to 5G is going to just take over like 3G did. And certainly in Europe, especially, it's fair to say that the Chinese manufacturers, Huawei and ZTE, have getting a lot of traction in the European market and also in the Asian market, which would be undermining Ericsson's sales position with customers.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. We hear a lot of stories around Huawei and ZTE coming in at substantially lower pricing. And that leaves Ericsson in a weak position. And ultimately, you end up with this cost cutting to save the company. And you just have to hope they don't cut muscle while they cut back.
They did note that they wouldn't touch research and development, which they still see as key. Ericsson's official response was, it's too soon to say what's going to happen, essentially. But if they're going to fire people, they'll certainly let those people know. So never happy to talk about layoffs. But
it's funny, isn't it? Like, a research and development's become a thing for some companies and not for others. Like, for example, Cisco has effectively zero research and development budget. That's not entirely true, but I don't want to overstate, you know, or exaggerate that too much. But Cisco doesn't really believe in spending money on R&D. It prefers to buy it in wholesale, and Ericsson's keeping its R&D going because it sees it a competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm. Different strokes, I guess.
Yeah, different business models, different things, yeah.
We talked a little bit about VMware earlier in the show. We've also got their financial results. They pulled in $1.9 billion in their fiscal Q2 earnings, which is up 12% year over year. That includes a net income of $334 million. I didn't know this, but more than half of VMware's revenue actually comes from software maintenance.
Yeah, well, if the only thing you sell is software, then the only maintenance you've got is?
That's your key income stream, yes.
That's pretty much it. And of course, VMware has been quite successful over the years in getting people to buy, particularly the hypervisor, ESX. And so now they're working on, now that business is landed and they have a foothold in a lot of customers, the goal is to expand that. And obviously that leads into NSX and vSAN and the cloud orchestrator, the vRealize and the end user compute. It's all about the fries with the burger, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Lots of headlines basically around this. First of all, is, you know, just how successful VMware has been in growing, while most of the other vendors are shrinking. Dell, of course, isn't shrinking. It's doing, seems to be doing pretty well by all reports. We won't know because there's no transparency around the results. But VMware is still a publicly held company. In the talk to analysts, Pat Gelsinger said that NSX was included in all of the top 10 deals of the quarter. Yeah. He went on to sort of talk about how VMware's NSX product is really key, or to hint at the fact that NSX is pretty much key to the success of their business overall. And the NSX license bookings grew over 40%. Not surprising given how much they're charging for it. secondly, they did a huge NFV deal with Vodafone. Now, many of the hypervisor companies want to start being involved in NFV. And if they've done a big NFV deal with Vodafone, they sort of went on and on about it several times in the call saying how fantastic it was. That means they might actually be trying to get a foothold into the carriers and actually getting there, where the carriers will start to replace their hardware devices that they've been buying from the vendors and start putting routers in as VMs and so forth. And if ESX has negotiated a successful deal there, that's going to hopefully give some momentum to the NFV market, saying it's actually on the table. But let's just wait and see. I think NFV is a much more complicated thing than we've got some hypervisors now. It's how you operate the NFV, the where the money comes in. It's not just having the functionality is important. And the call also talked extensively about multi-cloud. And I think next week you're going to see a lot of emphasis placed in the public sphere. So what the press is going to see and what the messaging that VMware wants you to hear is going to be focused very much on multi-cloud, this idea of private and public. And I think that the AWS, I'm beginning to think that the AWS partnership is a lot more strategic than we knew or than I originally realized. Ultimately, and I think I said this at the time, is that Azure Private Cloud is an on-ramp for Azure. That is, customers who today use, you know, Hyper-V can now deploy Azure Private Cloud, and then that transitions you over a 10-year, 20-year horizon into Azure. It's an on-ramp.
Yep.
To start consuming more services from Microsoft, and maybe you start using, you know, the cloud as a backup or a metadata store or, you know, whatever. And maybe VMware is hoping to do the same thing with AWS, so they become AWS's private cloud ramp.
Absolutely, that's a strategy, yes. And I wouldn't be surprised if we hear a lot more about that at VMworld next week.
It does feel like playing with a razor blade, though, doesn't it? you know, putting your business right in the camp of your strongest competitor, AWS. must be challenging. It must really feel like you're, you know, holding a two-edged sword.
Absolutely, yes. In that respect, I agree, because the public cloud is not something. Yeah, VMware needs to sort of treat AWS with kid gloves or at arm's length, sort of frenemy relationship, because the more workloads that go into public cloud is essentially less money that goes into VMware.
So maybe it's just a reaction to Azure Private Cloud and the feel that, you know, they need a public cloud partner that gives their people who are into the VMware strategy a public cloud solution that is blessed. So
yes, absolutely. All right, we started the show with Cisco, and I guess we're closing the show with Cisco. The website The Information reports that Cisco has had talks with Turbonomic about a possible acquisition. If you're not familiar with Turbonomic, they sell resource management software for premises and hybrid clouds, so essentially they track whether your workloads and applications are under or over-resourced, and you can automatically tweak resource management to appropriately provision those applications or workloads if you so choose to set it up automatically.
I think there's an echo in here, and it says intent-based computing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So intent for me is about this ability to monitor the status of a system and continually collect data from the system and then build that into some sort of model and then decide what to do. So if something happens, then the intent-based system should then go, I need to do something, and then just go and make that happen. So do an unattended, automated, non-human controlled change in the network. That's the ultimate goal of intent-based networking, is that you should say, you know, I want these things to happen. I want the network to operate in these parameters. I want my compute to do this. And then you walk away and the software just does that autonomously on its own, right?
Yep.
And Turbonomic is a step in that direction. I don't, despite the number of acquisitions that Cisco has made in this space around its ONE, One Enterprise strategy, I'm a little bit confused. It's a very complex strategy, has many moving parts. And it's very, there's nothing there that sort of sums it up easily that I can get from their website. But I would think this makes sense. It is only a rumor. It's not a confirmed rumor. And there's only one source, which is theinformation.com, which is a paywall. And unfortunately, I don't have a subscription to that. And I can't find anywhere else that the rumor is actually somewhere. So let's just wait and see. It does make sense at some level. I wouldn't put it on the prediction spreadsheet because I don't feel one way or the other, but it does. There is some logic to it.
Okay, a few other tidbits to go with that. Early this summer, Cisco did OEM Turbonomic as part of a new software package called Workload Optimization Manager, which is available on Cisco's UCS servers. So they already do have a partnership on the table. When I talked to Cisco about OEMing Turbonomic, they said they actually use it internally in their own data centers, so they're very familiar with it. Turbonomic has also partnered with HPE back in 2016. So if Cisco is really getting into being a more software-centric and intent-based organization, them picking up Turbonomic might take this off the table for a competitor like HPE. This is all speculation on my part. Another note, the information did say that Turbonomic is valued around $800 million. So if somebody's going to pony up, that's going to be a significant chunk of change.
I do feel that, you know, this, when we talked about SpringPath a minute ago, where they sort of had a suck it and see, you know, taste it,
exactly,
try it before you buy it.
Exactly.
And there might be, you know, maybe Cisco's gotten close enough to Turbonomic to say, you know, we quite like this, maybe we should have it. So, you know, just another factor to say there's some potential, but it's not something you can just easily go, that's ridiculous, walk away. I think there is something there.
There's a little smoke. We'll see if there's fire down the line.
Yeah, that's right. You know, yep.
All right, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, can you take a minute to tell us about the new Packet Pushers membership system we set up?
Yeah, so we've put together a membership system. The idea is in the long term for it to be a place where we can start to bring you more content, research papers that we gather up, links, of course. You get the link propagation newsletter where all the links that we draw together throughout the week as we, Ethan and Drew and I, do our research. We collect them and then send them out to you. We also have the Human Infrastructure Magazine, which is a bit of a personal take on being a human in IT. And if you become a member, it's free. You can sign up. There's just one level of membership today. So if you go to packetpushers.net/members, sign up, and then we've got a way to get more information to you in the months ahead as we build out a more of a content strategy that's going to be different, I think, in the long term.
That's right. And in the meantime, where can folks find you socially?
You can find me on Twitter as @EtherealMind. I'm over on LinkedIn as Greg Ferrer. You can find me there. I have a Facebook page, which I pretty much ignore, but you can follow me there. And there's some automation that puts the links and stuff there that if you want to see all that, I'd love to see you.
All right. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Twitter @Drew_CM. And I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsor, ExtraHop. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, please tell your friends or give it a like on Facebook or rate us on iTunes because that really helps. And you can find more fine free technical content, including blogs and podcasts at packetpushers.net. Now go have a donut.
Have two.
There you go.